Good morning. Understanding the worst mass shooting in U.S. history continues to take various forms in the search for its meaning. We'll talk with news analyst Neil Conan about how he's digesting this story. And addicts needing rehab are often told that means a 12-step program. This hour, we'll hear the fundamental differences of a contrarian approach. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. What does it take to keep our best and brightest here at home? Amber Imai is a local girl whose internship in the Akamai Workforce Initiative led her to a Hawaii-based career as an avionics engineer. She's with us in our studio. And pre-war Hawaii is a hotbed of intrigue in Victoria Nalani Newbold's new novel, Murder Frames the Scene.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, June 14th, Flag Day. Here's the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
You're looking at the conventional wisdom about rehabilitation, yeah?
And something that's not so conventional.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know that one of the tenets of 12-step programs is that alcoholics and addicts are in their disease. You hear that word a lot. To deal with it, those who ascribe to and follow the steps rely on each other and a higher power as they understand it. But a competing treatment philosophy looks at addiction differently. Founded in 1971, the Kaneohe nonprofit Habilitat veers away from a spiritual basis and says addiction is a matter of choice. Jay Dodson is the admissions coordinator. He's also a recovering addict and a graduate of the program. He's sitting in our studio with me this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
You've had a long history with Habilitat on sort of both sides of the fence, as a young man and an addict, and then again someone who recovered and then relapsed years later and then came back to the program and had to start from square one. And now you're its admissions director. In all of that, as you've seen now, you know, 30, 40 years worth of people who have come through, how do you draw those distinctions between what we hear and the conventional wisdom, people are in their disease, as opposed to this is a matter of choice?
I think that a glaring example of some of the deficiencies of the short-term programs that usually subscribe to the disease concept, I would venture to say that 80% of the kids in the program now have been through multiple short-term programs with no success.
Who have been through, or who are at your program now, have been through others with no success.
Right.
And in part, why? Because 28 days or 30 days seems to be just too short?
Yeah, I'm afraid that the saying sort of is that it creates short-term sobriety and multiple relapses. It's sort of an accepted part of the modality of, you know, a program that runs 28 days, that perhaps that length of time, let's be honest, was designed by what the insurance companies will pay, and not necessarily on this is the amount of time that we need to work with somebody to get them to, you know, understand about themselves and the reasons that they did the things they did.
Very often, though, the rehab centers will say that directly. This is what insurance will pay for, and say that, you know, the money has to come from somewhere to keep their doors open. You've managed to do something a little differently because you're a nonprofit and you have income streams that you saw created during the last 30, 40 years to be able to create a self-sustaining situation. But beyond that difference, when you talk about choice, you're really sometimes talking about people who come into their teens with not a lot of self-worth, with not a lot of understanding of who they are, who have been through some pretty terrible circumstances that didn't let them even find out any of those things. How do you start to treat someone in that place and say, you know, you made some bad choices?
I think that, you know, we start from the very beginning. In other words, there's no amount of money. You can't buy your way into our program. You can't be incarcerated and have us appear for you in court and ask the judge to allow you to, you know, come to habilitate to our program without, you know, extensive screening. And what we're really looking for is a basic, strong desire to want to change your life. And so I think that's a big difference, you know, that it's not that easy. We're known to be the toughest program. I think one of the local judges called us the gold standard, that, you know, sometimes they would, someone that's incarcerated or something that might have the opportunity to enter into rehabilitation as opposed to a prison sentence, they want to choose us last in some respect, you know, if they're not really ready. So, you know, we sort of demand that somebody really have that desire to want to change prior to even allowing them into the program. So we get that starting point from them, not from what we say.
And Jay Dodson, what does that look like when you say they have to be really ready in a starting point? What does that sound like? What do you listen for?
Just that they recognize, you know, that all the mistake, that they take responsibility completely for everything that's done, whether they're coming from a prison system or whether they're coming from the street, regardless of the drug that they use, whether it was methamphetamines or opiates, all the things that are big out there now. That's the main thing that we want them to understand, is that, you know, these are issues that you created, and these are this is the pain that you left behind. You know, your mother's tears, everything. We want them to understand, you know, whether they're if they have children, you know, that you probably took food out of your children's mouth, you know, to ingest, to purchase drugs, you know, all of these what we consider to be very selfish acts, which is common with somebody that is just missing that level of self-worth that you spoke about.
Addicts are known to being pretty selfish, and
it's a selfish sport
to do to get whatever it is they need to get. Hawaii Public Radio's news department just finished a podcast in conjunction with Civil Beat about Hawaii's new ice age, about meth. As you just said a moment ago, it doesn't matter what the drug is. Does that mean that you treat all drug addiction the same, and that it's not something that, when we talk about meth and the proliferation of meth in Hawaii, that's not something that you address specifically, because to you all the drugs are just simply,
I mean,
whatever
the
embodiment of addiction is?
It's just the sniffle of the cold. I mean, it really is not relevant what particular drug that they abuse, with the exception of we became aware early on with the ice Batu epidemic, you know, here in Hawaii, that they come to us quite damaged very quickly. You know, you would think that the heroin addiction or something like that would be so physically destructive. I mean, by far, I think the methamphetamine addicts go downhill so quickly, within a matter of a couple of years. I mean, you barely recognize them. They look like they've aged 30 years, and it's sad, but it's It's repairable as well.
In the repair that you have seen in all the time that you've been with Habilitat, both with yourself on several occasions now and other people who have come through it, what's your success rate?
You know, I read recently in one of our current brochures that it was 64%. And that's actually a quite high success rate, but it doesn't sound like it. If it's not in the 90s or something, somebody's going to say 64%.
Well, usually when people hear from Alcoholics Anonymous, it's at 5%. And yet that represents thousands and millions of people worldwide, that's a lot of people.
But I think it's also based, I think that figure is also based on people that complete the program. Whereas, you know, and we're a long-term program, so you'll have people that won't complete the program, and we don't count them in our success rate.
But they have to go through the whole 11 months?
I'm sorry?
They have to go through the entire 11 months for you to count them.
Actually, it's 24 to 28 months. The 11 months I was speaking of was my return many years ago. But it's a 2 to 2.5 year program. I believe I entered the program in February of 1975 and graduated September of 1977. So I think
you better
about
be prepared
30
for
months.
A long-term commitment is what you're saying coming
and,
into.
And we stress that, you know, to anybody coming into the program that this is what's required. I mean,
and that too is a choice. Jay Dobson, thank you so much for coming in. Good to talk to you.
Nice talking with you.
Jay Dobson is the admissions coordinator for Habilitat. He's also a recovering addict and graduate of the Habilitat program and has worked there for over 14 years. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:17, shortly to be 8:18. Coming up, reaping the benefits of STEM education, but first, a backyard quiz.
Ulana, o mau, o kaho o lawe, o Hawaii.
It's well known that Hawaii has a problem with invasive species. The mild climate and lack of major predators make the Hawaiian Islands a fertile habitat for plants and animals from all over the world. Mongoose, small hive beetle, mosquitoes, and even the kiawe tree are all examples of successful invasive species in Hawaii. One of the most interesting is also one of the most elusive. The wallaby is a small mammal from Australia belonging to the same family as the kangaroo. And apart from the size, they're so similar you might easily mistake a wallaby for a young kangaroo. Hawaii has a small but stable population of wild wallabies on Oahu. The exact population size is difficult to determine because they're skittish, but estimates place the colony at around 40 individuals living in Kalihi Valley. Wallabies are native to Australia, but were brought to Hawaii in the early 20th century as exhibits for a private zoo. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know what was the name of the man who owned this zoo. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Willoughby wallaby wee, an elephant sat on me. Willoughby wallaby woo, an elephant sat on you. Willoughby wallaby Weston, an elephant sat on Justin.
Good morning. I'm Jeff Bannister from Hawaii Pacific University. You're listening to The Conversation on HBR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The growth of so-called STEM programs, science, technology, engineering, and math, has been a bright spot on the educational landscape that has done much to erase old stereotypes about science. STEM students know that few things can match the excitement of discovery and invention and advanced problem solving, the kind of thinking that kind of education fosters. Amber Imai is an avionics engineer who got her start as an intern with the Akamai Workforce Initiative. She's found something all too rare for young people in Hawaii, a challenging career in science close to home. She's with us in our studio. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning, Chris.
You knew you were going to be working in science from an early age. Why is that?
So my backstory is a little bit, I wanted to go into biomedical engineering because I wanted to help people who are disabled or injured and the people who support them.
Which takes a lot of science, technology, math knowledge, right?
Yeah. So my mother's disabled and has been since I was around 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And she has a neurological disorder, so she's been deteriorating over time. This meant that I wanted to try to help her and help my father as well. Mm-hmm. So that kind of led me into robotics, which got me my first internship at Joint Astronomy Center in Hilo, which then led me to learn about the Akamai program from their final talks that they did at the end of their program.
You started pursuing internships and educational opportunities outside of school from a pretty early age, huh?
Yeah, I started when I was 16. I worked at Joint Astronomy Center for the summer, and that turned into a senior project for my high school career.
Over the course of this time, did you find other kids like you who wanted to sort of follow that path, work in science and stay in Hawaii?
Yeah, definitely. I've mentored a lot of students. A lot of my friends also are trying to find jobs in the STEM industries, and it's very difficult for them.
But they find them elsewhere, right?
Yeah, so some of my friends work at Sony, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Microsoft, a lot of the big names, but they're all on the mainland.
And you had the chance to do that too, yeah?
I did. I had a few opportunities to leave Hawaii, but Hawaii is where my heart is, and I really would like to stay in the islands.
You know, when you first think about becoming a scientist, an astronomer, an avionics engineer, the amount of information that you have to accumulate can seem overwhelming, can't it?
It does, but it's a slow accumulation over time, just like anything else.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to adapt to that idea pretty early? It sounds that way.
Yeah. So my father's a technician. When I was little, he worked on pinball machines and jukeboxes, and I got to help him with that. He also worked on computers, small home appliances, and it was a lot of fun to just kind of tinker with him as a child. And growing up, I got to work on cars and those kinds of things, and it was a lot of fun.
You know, I certainly, in my own education, ran into this whole idea that science was anything but fun. But when you understand it, in a way, what could be more enjoyable, right?
Yeah, science is all around us, and it's in our everyday life. And I really enjoy like working and learning more about it. And I was very fortunate that a lot of people around me were able to instill in me that science is fun. And it's something that's necessary to learn about.
And if you can get that idea across that it is a source of enjoyment as well as a source of knowledge, you can get a lot of people on board with the whole idea of learning science, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the reason that robotics is a huge success in the islands, is that robotics gives a goal, a very clear goal, and something to work towards. It's the fun of the competition, and it's like its own sport.
You know, what would you like if you could sort of bring about changes in the world around you, in the world here in Hawaii, to create more opportunities? What are some things that, you know, in an ideal world you might like to see?
I'd love to see more STEM jobs. I'd love to see more research opportunities here in the islands. And I really would like to see a growth in the science community here.
In your own, you do a lot of mentoring, as you said, of local kids. Do you see a lot of that same drive that you have, not only to work in science, but to stay here?
Definitely. A lot of students have family here, family that don't want to leave to go to the mainland and have careers here. So if they leave, that means that they have to come back as a vacation time, but they would prefer to stay here.
And some of them have sort of been forced to follow their careers by going somewhere else.
Yes, because there isn't a whole lot of opportunities for engineering and science here.
How have you managed to do it for yourself?
It's been a lot of hard work. I have been doing summer internships as an undergraduate. Even before that, with Joint Astronomy Center, I worked with the Akamai program for one summer at Joint Astronomy Center, and I really want to work back in the astronomy field because I'm originally from Hilo. But I've also worked with optical engineering, and I've done a lot of small satellite projects.
Do you think it's necessary to make that kind of decision early as far as a course for your life? Because, you know, a lot of kids don't really find a course of action for themselves until they're well into their college years. And, you know, they might go just as far eventually, but is it really kind of essential to make that early decision?
I don't think it's as essential to make the early decision as much as it is essential to do networking. You need to get your foot out there, meet people, meet professionals in the industry so that you have a more fighting chance of staying in Hawaii. There will be people who are on the sidelines rooting for you.
You had mentors pretty early who kind of told you that, right? That you were... that's what you're going to need to do.
Yeah, definitely. One of my biggest mentors has been Art Kimura, who started the robotics programs here, and he started Future Flight Hawaii, which is an outreach program that I now help with.
So you're sort of part of a cycle of getting and giving back is what it sounds like.
Yeah, I try very hard to give back because growing up in Keauʻu, as one of the underprivileged people there, it was difficult, and I wouldn't be where I am without a lot of help. I wouldn't be where I am without a lot of people helping me.
Chances are, Amber, people are going to be saying that about you, don't you think?
I hope so, eventually.
I hope so, too. I think it's very possible. Thanks a lot for coming in, Amber. Really good to meet you.
Thank you.
Amber Imai is a 2008 alumna of the Akamai Workforce Initiative, which is a program that directs Hawaii college students toward science and technology careers. She now works as an avionics engineer for the Hawaii Space Flight Lab at UH Manoa, where she designs, fabricates, and tests small satellite components.
Don't wanna be second best, don't wanna stand in line, don't wanna fall behind, don't wanna get caught out, don't want to do now.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
After tragedy, looking for solutions to America's gun problem.
In Africa, we've taken nearly 55,000 assault rifles out of circulation when at the very beginning of that project, people told us we'd never get one.
One man's mission to transform weapons into art and make at least some impact. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
The next time you're on the road, see if you can spot one of Hawaii Public Radio's more than 4,000 sustaining members. Some of them are sporting a license plate frame which says exactly that. And we'd like to send a big mahalo to these supporters whose monthly contributions provide the station with a source of reliable monthly income. Kate Payne of Honolulu, Kim Schneider of Honaunau, and Dan Foley of Kailua. And if you'd like to help steer a stable course for HPR into the future, we'd welcome your sustained support at hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can give us a call to find out more at 955-8821. When the deal-making turned to NextEra, several other energy companies believe they got the ultimate cold shoulder. Hawaiian electric companies canceled their power purchase agreements. Civil Beat's Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Okay, so it's been 18 months since the NextEra deal was first talked about. And what we've been looking at since then seems to be a real change of how the company has been dealing with other companies with whom it had these purchase agreements or power purchase agreements. Is this really coordinated, or is this coincidence?
Well, you know, if it is a coincidence, it's a pretty big one. Think about it. NextEra, of course, is waiting, as is Hawaiian Electric, to hear what the PUC does in terms of their merger, and we're hoping to hear about that this summer. But Nathan Eagle took a look over what else has happened over the last 18 months or so, and just think about it. Hawaiian Electric has actually pulled the plug, so to speak, on various power deals. I'm going to name them. Hawaii Gas, they were working on an agreement on importing liquefied natural gas. That appears to be off the table because Hawaiian Electric is looking elsewhere for that. A power purchase agreement was canceled with Huhonua Bioenergy. They terminated a contract, this again being Hawaiian Electric, with Sun Edison. You heard about that one, to construct solar farms on Oahu. And then there's a fourth one. There was a plan to facilitate geothermal on the Big Island. That is not going to happen either. Now, we did talk to Hawaiian Electric. They said no. All this is done on a case-by-case decision. It is not being done to better position NextEra should the deal go through, the merger. But you know, with the energy officials that we talked to said, boy, what a coincidence.
Okay, so what about the PUC? Because clearly that caught the eye of Randy Iwase, too.
Right. He's the chair of the Public Utilities Commission, and of course he and two other commissioners will be making that decision on the merger. He chose not to speculate, but he definitely has raised concerns about the timing, about the business deals. In particular, he mentioned the Huhonua situation and Sun Edison. That was of concern to him as he weighs, along with his fellow commissioners, whether to approve this deal.
Why did he say he was especially concerned?
Well, he understands that, you know, Sun Edison was a business deal, and there was a concern that financially it was not a good idea. But it doesn't look good in the fact that you're trying to set up a deal with NextEra. This is a company that is not known, according to the officials that we spoke to, with dealing with smaller contracts and independents. It prefers to focus on large utility-owned projects rather than these other groups. You could call it a do-it-yourself approach rather than partnering. And that's a concern for a company that's trying to essentially become our major utility, at least on all the major islands, with exception of Kauai, of course, which has its own utility co-op.
Which is bringing up the same question. Are we just swapping one for another that's going to have the same type of control? Okay, we're going to leave it there for the moment, Chad, but we'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and he joins us every day with a reality check.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook at 8:34. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can get in touch with us through our talkback line at 808-792-8217, or our Facebook page on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or on Twitter at HI Conversation. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. And coming up, murder and espionage against the background of territorial days.
Most Tuesdays, we talk with news analyst Neil Conan about politics and the international news. This is one of those days where there is really only one story as we struggle with the shock and grief and anger from the worst mass shooting in our history and begin to come to terms with what it all means. Good morning, Neil, and it's good to have you here.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
One of the problems with this atrocity in Orlando is that so many people are talking about it in so many different ways, and we all seem to be having trouble defining exactly what happened. What do you see?
Yeah, Orlando lies at the intersection of homophobia and lone wolf terrorism. It's not like Fort Hood or San Bernardino. It's not like Sandy Hook or Aurora. We simply can't ignore the fact that this happened at a gay nightclub. Lots of other things are involved here, I think, but first and foremost, it seems to me, this was homophobic rage.
In the phone calls with the police, though, the shooter pledged his support for ISIS. Isn't that an important fact to remember, too?
Sure, but if you listen to everything he said, it's all over the map. He pledged allegiance to ISIS, yes, but in the past, he's also supported an Al-Qaeda group and Hezbollah. These three groups are bitter enemies. Support for one automatically excludes the others. So there's no religious or ideological consistency here. At one point, he called the Tsarnaev brothers his homies. Those, of course, are the men who set off bombs at the Boston Marathon a couple of years ago. But, you know, even that doesn't seem consistent to me. An attack on a major event like the Boston Marathon is clearly an attack on the United States, a retaliation, however misguided, for American foreign policy. The Pulse nightclub is not that. This is homophobic rage, you know, maybe dressed up in religious rationalization, but fundamentally homophobic rage.
The Islamic State, though, has claimed Omar Mateen as one of its own.
Well, you know, there doesn't seem to be anything too vile for the Islamic State as long as it involves the blood of its enemies, and the more the better. Two things. It's important to point out that most of those enemies are Muslims. Shias, yes, but you know, loads of Sunni Muslims, too. And the vast majority of the people it's killed are in places like Baghdad and Beirut, not to mention, you know, it has bloody-minded affiliates in places like Nigeria and Libya. The other point is that there's absolutely no evidence that Mateen was in contact with anybody from ISIS, and that earlier FBI investigation found that his claims to be, you know, some kind of, you know, radical, we're you know, phony, just posing.
If you say, though, that the, you know, the heart of this attack is really homophobia, some would also say that you could trace that back to the shooter's faith, to the utter rejection of homosexuality in the Quran. Doesn't that hold some weight, too?
Yeah, but, you know, the Quran doesn't have exactly a monopoly on that. The Old Testament is just as harsh. You know, there's lots we still don't know, but I suspect at the base we will find a homophobe. Now, that is often linked to men who are unable to deal with their own homosexuality. There are reports we're seeing today that Mateen had been seen before at the Pulse nightclub, you know, apparently trying to pick up men. We don't know that for sure, but, you know, I think that's what is going to be at the base of this.
All right, exactly, and hearing a lot of that speculation today. But let's talk about the reaction to the attack. Unlike 9/11, unlike the Boston Marathon, this attack does not seem to have unified people.
No, it hasn't. And part of that, I think, is that we're in election mode, and part of that is due to the extraordinary response of Donald Trump. You know, just a week ago, he'd been restrained by the revulsion within the Republican Party to his wild attacks on a federal judge. He came close to an apology. He started to read speeches off teleprompters. Now, that's been cast aside as he's congratulated himself for, as he put it, being right. He doubled down on his idea to ban Muslims from entering the country. He said that should be expanded to include anybody from countries involved with terrorist attacks on Americans. He didn't really have to find how that would work. He insinuated that President Obama and Hillary Clinton were somehow enabling these attacks. He issued a bunch of outright lies and distortions. So, you know, that mask of presidential demeanor just slipped right back off.
This bluster and the Muslim ban in particular still played pretty well for Trump in the Republican primaries, and some folks think that this could help him to be the victor in the general election, too, and that in this case, Omar Mateen might have just ushered Donald Trump into the White House.
You know, I don't think so. You know, this might get him a bump in the polls. We're going to have to see about that. But in the long run, what we've seen in these past couple of days is Trump defiant. He's thrown off all the restraints. Again, he's, you know, seized by that certainty that, you know, unbridled, unscripted Trump will conquer all. Now, he did speak yesterday from a teleprompter, but strayed way off script. Now, this might work on this issue for this week, but in the long run, he will expose himself over and over again and drive people away. Now, by contrast, Secretary Clinton's speech was sympathetic, cautious, full of policy points on plans to attack ISIS. And some would say she got swamped by Trump's bombast that he won the news cycle. Short-run success, maybe. But, you know, that sense that he's dangerous, out of control, incoherent, that's going to hurt him over time. Now, just to point out, in the middle of this, Trump blacklisted the Washington Post for a headline he didn't like. Now, there have been, you know, lots of candidates and politicians who didn't like the press in general or specific outlets in particular. But, you know, Richard Nixon didn't lift the Post credentials during Watergate. He didn't ban the New York Times or the White House press office when it published the Pentagon Papers. And again, you know, in the short run, Trump may get some points for bashing the media. But this is Trump living down to that image that Hillary Clinton skewered so deftly in her speech a couple of weeks ago and over the long, long haul of the next 6 months. You know, I don't think it's going to play.
All right. Well, we're talking long hauls here, just to shift briefly. The very last Democratic primary happens today in Washington, D.C. Bernie Sanders got clobbered last week in New Jersey and California. He lost to other states as well, but he didn't end his campaign then. He didn't end it when the president, the vice president, Elizabeth Warren, endorsed Hillary Clinton. Is tonight the night?
He says no, that he plans to stay in the race all the way to the convention floor. But, you know, this is just a formality at this point. It looks like that steady torrent of small contributions that sustained him for so long has largely dried up. Staffers said that California came as a surprise, for example, because the campaign didn't have the money to poll in California the last couple of weeks. At least half the campaign staff has been laid off. Sanders hopes to leverage an endorsement for influence at the convention and for influence on the shape of the Democratic Party to come. You know, and those two things, that's politics. That ought to be doable. And both he and I think the vast majority of his supporters are going to be ready to join the fight against Donald Trump.
Well, I know you're going to be traveling next Tuesday, so when we talk again, I know we'll have lots more to talk about. Have safe travels. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay, you bet, Bethany.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm, and you can also hear his specific news minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. Today in the Backyard Quiz, we asked you for the name of the man who brought wallabies to Hawaii in the early 1900s. Hawaii's original wallaby population numbered just 3 when our aspiring zookeeper brought them to his residence in Aloha Heights. But in 1916, a pack of dogs attacked the cage housing the wallabies, allowing 2 of them to escape into the forest, a male and a female, as fate would have it. Nature, of course, took its course, and the wallaby population began to grow, eventually stretching from, all the way into the Nuuanu Valley. Now, there's no firm evidence to confirm, but there's speculation that wild pigs and dogs and even some human activity curtailed the growth of the wallaby population, and it's a rare instance of an invasive species in Hawaii being controlled without significant human intervention. Today, Hawaii's sole wallaby colony can be found in Halawa Valley, not far from where their original ancestors escaped to freedom from Richard Trent's private zoo. That's the name we were looking for. Nobody got it, so we'll just keep our little T-shirt till tomorrow. But if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can send it in any time to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The writer of a murder mystery faces a number of challenges. The puzzle needs to keep our curiosity alive to keep those pages turning. The sleuths need to enlist our sympathy, making us feel as if we share in their discoveries. And their world should be one that's rich in atmosphere, one that piques our curiosity. In Victoria Nalani Newbold's new novel, Murder Frames the Scene, the world is the territory of Hawaii in the years leading up to the Second World War, where crime and international intrigue are all in the air. Victoria's on the phone with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. You know, a genre mystery is a good way to sort of get a window into a time and place, which is what you've done with this book, yeah?
Yes, I love the mystery genre. And, of course, as you can probably tell, I love the place that I was born and raised in. And I really feel like fiction is a way to, you know, not only preserve history and the place that we live in, but also to introduce people to things that concern us in the island
mm-hmm.
through a kind of a hopefully a fun and intriguing medium.
Yeah, it makes the pill easier to swallow, right?
When you... Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean to describe a history as a pill, but you know what I mean? The whole idea of nonfiction versus fiction. Fiction can actually teach us a lot, can't it?
Yes, it can. And, you know, my theory about learning is that when you're having fun, you're going to learn much more easily.
Oh, yeah, that's more than a theory. I mean, I think that's a lot of people would agree with that.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
So how do you make this is a very vivid time and place that you're dealing with and one that we didn't get a chance to live through ourselves. How do you make it come alive?
Well, you know, I do a lot of research and because I enjoy doing research so much and I was just thinking today how much I actually learn myself from writing these mystery stories.
Mm-hmm.
But I do a lot of research, and, you know, this was the time period that my parents grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a little girl, I used to love to eavesdrop on their conversations and, you know, listen to what they said about certain places and listen to their reminiscences. So I draw a lot on, you know, those things I heard as a little girl, too. But I think, you know, just like a visual artist, I think a writer needs to, you know, learn how to look and observe and kind of translate what they're seeing into more subtle shades.
Mm-hmm. And the kind of observation that a writer does is different from a civilian's observation, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think everybody looks at the world in a different way. But, you know, as a writer, I think you have to look a little more closely. And you have to enjoy the translation of what you are seeing, thinking, feeling. You have to enjoy the translation of all of that into character and through your characters into certain words.
You know, Victoria, I'm thinking of an exchange between Holmes and Dr. Watson in which Watson asks Holmes how he's able to make his deductions. And Holmes says, well, how many times have you climbed the stairs to our apartment? And have you ever counted how many stairs there are? And then he says to Watson, you look, but you do not observe. You know how that sort of... That's kind of the difference, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, and I think for myself, I started out wanting to be a visual artist, and I'm always telling my husband, you know, the things that I learned. I went to the Honolulu Academy of Arts, that's what it was called then, to the studio program, and Louis Pohl was my drawing and painting teacher. And I always tell people, you know, I learned a lot about writing from being in his studios.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Just because you have to give an attention to detail that you didn't perhaps think you were going to have to, right?
Yes, you have to slow down, and you have to learn to look at the physical world in a different way.
You know, a lot of people just in conversation, when they try to describe something that they, even something they know well, they find themselves stalling. I certainly do. You stall because you haven't really made that translation into what words will convey what this thing looks like, right?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, as a writer, you know, you don't have to come up with the words right away like you do in a conversation.
That's a good point.
You have some time to sit and think about it, and you have some time to go back and edit yourself, too, which, unfortunately, in our conversations, we don't. You know, we can't do, although sometimes I'm sure we wish we could.
Well, we're doing okay so far, right?
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is essential in a mystery, and you've certainly accomplished in this one, is having, you have to care about the people trying to solve the mystery. And in your case, it's also an added layer, which is the relationship between your two sleuths, right?
Well, I hope people, sympathize and identify with the protagonists in my novel, because I tried to make them, people that we might like to be ourselves in some ways, but still, you know, be people who have, their own little problems too. And I actually based some of the characters on people that I kind of knew, but just changed them a little bit. And, you know, like the plot itself, too, is based on an actual case of spying at Pearl Harbor that happened a little bit later, in the decade. But I kind of took that material and used it in my mystery, too. But I'm not going to say who it was, because that would be a spoiler.
No, don't do that. No matter what inducements you get, Victoria. But that's what writers are supposed to do. And I think you've clearly had a lot of fun putting this one together.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's why I do a lot of work in the history field, and I enjoy writing these mysteries because it gives me a little more freedom than just sticking to the facts. And although I do try and, you know, portray history the way it was, kind of.
Yeah, the fiction gives you the freedom, but the history's got to be accurate. And that's something that works out well in this kind of fiction. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, a real pleasure. Victoria Nalani Newbull is the author of Murder Frames the Scene, published by the University of Hawaii Press. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Antonio Salieri was a respected and popular composer of his day, not a jealous rival of Mozart, as depicted in Amadeus. This is Joe Moore inviting you to tune in to HPR 1 on Sunday, June 19th, for the first broadcast of my radio drama, Malign Master, The Glory of Salieri, featuring his music and F. Murray Abraham as the ghost of Salieri. June 19th, 3 p.m., only on Hawaii Public Radio.
Beth Ann, it's a day to search for encouragement in the stories that we tell, and our encounter with a young scientist who's made a career here in Hawaii was a very encouraging story.
And we need that, and that's the whole point. That doesn't take away anything from the heinous nature of the stories that we have to cover, but they also have to be balanced with hope. And there's a lot of it out there. Glad
that's
we were
right.
able to talk to her yeah. today. Now, tomorrow, did you know that there is an ongoing partnership between UH and the Jindal Global Law School? We're going to talk with its dean, Raj Kumar, who is in town for the India-Hawaii Law Symposium.
And Adaptations Dance Theater is having a world premiere to its Bring It Home dance concert.
If you hear something on the show that makes you cheer or talk back to your radio, talk back to us on the Talk Back line, 808-792-8217.
And find recordings of past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right back here for more of The Conversation.